So you are warmly welcome to this analyzing and reporting survey data course. My name is Noona Kiuru. I work as university researcher at Department of Psychology, and my background is that I have content-wise background in psychology, but aside of that, I have made some studies in master studies in statistics too. And I will give this first lecture, and then the second lecture will be given by Professor Asko Tolvanen. And then afternoon you will have some group work, and you will get credits for this course based on active participation today. So if somebody of you is unable to attend afternoon's meeting, as I understood, there will be some possibility to do some written work also. But I put this name list going around so that we know who are here. And we have thought to construct this course so that first I will give some introduction to statistical analysis, talk a little bit about choosing the right method, and then some examples of reporting statistical results in some basic analyses like cross-tabulation, t-test, variance analysis and regression analysis. And then Asko will go a bit, some steps further, and we'll discuss about analyze strategy and reporting results when you use structural equation modeling, and also some extension to multilevel modeling and mixture modeling. So I guess the aim of this course is to give you some idea about statistical thinking, and then when you think that you have certain data and then you have certain research questions, then to think about what would be the best statistical method. And then also, well, of course we don't have time to go very details of all the technical details of carrying out those analyses, but more like the idea and then ideas about reporting, as most of you are doing your PhD studies or then writing articles. I guess that these things are something that are really important. It's really nice morning, nice sunshine, and nice to see so many people eager to learn statistics here. So here is the structure that I thought for this first lecture. And before starting the actual topics, I would like to remind you for some very important things that probably are not sufficiently enough kind of emphasized in different courses, but these are kind of like very important preliminary first steps when you get your new data and before it's worthwhile to even start any statistical analysis. And regarding the quality of subject and analysis, it's good always to check that whether your measures behave well, sort of behave well as you expect. Is there some variability? If it's so that everybody has answered yes and nobody answers anything else, then there is no variance what to kind of model. And then depending your method that you plan to use, how the basic assumptions such as normality assumption or some other statistical assumptions are met. And one thing that is really important is of course to check that if there are any data entering or coding errors. Just simple thing, but check minimum and maximum values to be sure that there are no mistakes or something strange in the data. If you have some extreme outliers in your data, it can have huge impact. Like, for example, if sample size is small, it might be that you will get some huge correlation even though there is nothing in reality. and then have some inspection how much there is missing data in your data, how it's organized, its missingness of the data, somehow systematic, whether it's worthwhile to consider some imputation or somehow handling this missingness. And well, then regarding outliers, if there are just some coding errors in entering data in computers, for example, then of course it's good to correct. But if there are real outliers, then usually they need some processing, just as well, sometimes even kind of getting rid of those cases. But I guess that at least, well, my background is in psychology, and quite often we have longitudinal data and we think that every case is important, all the information is important, what we have in the data. So usually we don't want to throw any cases away, but rather maybe just end exceptional value, just move them to the end of the distribution or something like that, so that order of the observations remain as it is, but then outliers do not impact so negatively the distribution. But now, well, in this course we assume that these things are all right and you have nice high quality data, and then we consider other things to think about when you are selecting, you are doing statistical reasoning and selecting your statistical tools. And first I would like to give you some introduction to statistical analysis. And it might be that some things are very familiar, but I think it's good to have some reminder about certain things and certain problems there are in statistical reasoning. So because it impacts also how you interpret your results, whether you share only one point estimate or p-value, or whether you consider also some effect sizes and your sample size and things like that, that also impact how easy it's to get statistically significant results. And I guess that one important difference is whether you are interested in just descriptive statistics, descriptive data analysis, or actual statistical inference. And you could say that descriptive statistical analysis summarizes information about the properties of the variables and associations between variables. Typically this is when you look distributions, mean, standard deviations, maybe medians or some other statistics too. But then your aim is not to make inferences about the population. Sometimes this kind of descriptive data analysis can be somehow already answer some of your research questions, something like what kind of answers there are in the data. But also in almost any article that you probably have read also reports some descriptive statistics. When you carry out some more complex statistical analysis, typically it's always based on means or medians or correlations or something like that. So it's very important that you show also your raw data and understand your raw data before you take next steps. And then if we think about statistical inference, then in turn it's possible to make conclusions about target population, at least in nice world show. But of course then you have to think that there are many things to think about, how representative your sample is from the actual population, and do you have somehow unique sample and things like that. And here is some graphical example of this idea. We can think that there is some target population of the study, like Finnish children or children in the world, or those students who are highly competitive in sports, or you might have some different target populations where you aim to do some generalizations. And then typically it's not possible to study all the kids that are born in Finland. It's just too much work usually. So typically research is carried out so that you will obtain some random sample or samples from the target population, and you try to sample them so that it makes sense to think about that they might be somehow, the sample might be somehow representative of the target population. But then you still have to think about that, are there some observations, do you manage to get all the those children that you aim to get in your sample, for example? Is it so that some parents decline to the children to participate, and are those children whose parents say that no, my child cannot participate, are those families somehow different? If they are, it might be that you don't have completely representative sample and have to these things have to be taken into account when you try to make some generalizations based on your data. And then another thing is, if you carry out some longitudinal study, is it so that you manage to study all the children at every time point, or is it like at some, so there are some kind of blanks in the data, some children you just manage to study in some time points, but in some time points you don't, and are some participants dropping out in the middle of the data, and those who chose to drop out, are they somehow different from your original sample? Then it's of course good if you have managed to have good measurement from of your sample at first time point, then you of course can use this information to predict possible dropout also in your models. And then of course thinking about this nature of missing data in your beginning of the data, is it completely missing at random, or not missing and random? I think Asko might talk about this a bit more, but this missing completely at random would mean that there are no external variables or no variables in the data that would explain the pattern of missingness, but it's just, if somebody is missing, it's just completely random and you have completely representative sample. Missingness at random means that you don't have any, you at least hope that you as a researcher have managed to measure those things that are relevant to the phenomenon that you study, and you have those variables in the data that might explain some pattern of missingness. And but then outside your data, there are no other variables that might explain missingness. And in this case, you can, of course, use all this information. And then, of course, situation that missingness is not random at all. Well, I have here some examples of reporting descriptive statistics, just some example tables. Of course, I guess that depending on your research field, there might be different kind of rules, what kind of tables, like formatting rules. But I guess that for myself, those APA rules, American Psychological Association rules, are quite familiar. I guess that in education, different education journals too, it might be that there are some differences in fields, but I guess that from these table examples you still get some ideas how you might present your descriptive data in your papers, or then of course in statistical results too. But here is example of Kinta's research, who is also in this room actually, and about reporting demographic background characteristics. Sometimes if you have a lot of background information, it might be very heavy if you list all the small percentages and means and so on in your participant description, sometimes it might be useful to think about whether you could describe your data, your demographics, family characteristics, in this case, mother's characteristics, child's characteristics, and so on in the table. So typically sample size, maybe percentages, percent if you have some categorical variables like girls and boys and birth order and family structure, then maybe means and standard deviation if you have some continuous variables such as child's age and maybe some range. This already tells quite much about your sample. And well, another picture is in Finnish, but I try to explain in English what is it from Kinnunen's and colleagues' instructions actually to do thesis in Department of Psychology. And this is here mainly because I wanted to just provide an example how you might illustrate your descriptive results in a figure if you have something so interesting in your descriptive findings that you want to show it more illustrative way. And in this case there are different factors and to what extent kind of partners, marital partners agree or disagree what they kind of are arguing about, like household world, work, time together, money, alcohol, expressing emotions, habits, and religion. So, for example, in this case, I think it's quite nice example to illustrate those proportions in figure rather than just in text. You can point out where there is I guess there is most agreement in regarding alcohol, that there is partners agree that there is some disagreements in that. And there is another example of reporting descriptive statistics. Quite often it might be, well, you have in table some title, of course, then you might number your variables and write their names. You might have longitudinal data, same variables measured at several times. Then quite often what you report in the descriptive data table, in this case variables are continuous, sample size, mean standard deviation, in this case also skewness and scurtosis value have been reported, that give some indication about the distribution, and then minimum and maximum values. Quite often you report something like that, and if you don't, then reviewers ask you to do. And then here is an other example of reporting descriptive statistics. It's quite similar than the previous example, but I just wanted to highlight in this case, this is actually paper that was also one for afternoon's group work regarding reporting regression analysis, and in SPSS context, and then there are some distributional assumptions. Well, Asko will talk about more about M+ program and other programs which may have some estimators and some possibilities to handle in case the variables are not so beautifully normal. But here is a kind of I think nice example illustrate what kind of transformation were needed in order to achieve normality assumptions for the analyses that were actually then carried out in the using parametric methods. And here is another example in the table of reporting descriptive results. This was from Katarina Salmela-Aro's data, kind of life history calendar where participants reported from, it was, I think, 18-year time about when they reported different things that happened in their life. And this kind of table summarized the information quite beautifully, their residence situation. But this was the first time point was when participants started their university studies, and in the last time point they of course have been already in working life. But then there are four different line domains, like residence, whether they still live at family home with their own parents, or whether they have some rented apartment or owner occupation. And you can see that start of date of studies is very low, but then when they get older, of course, proportions get bigger. Same thing in partnership, first singles are main category, but then single category is just decreasing across time, and then partnership category increasing, and parenthood also, like first almost nobody has children, and then also about career, studying and work across time, and then working full time. And here you can see something about, well, this sample was a long time ago, but still you can see something about graduation times also at this time. And here is an example of reporting correlation matrix. And this is quite often you might number your variables, and then you use same number in this horizontal row, and then you don't need space so much, and then you can fill your numbers in table. And well, in this case there are stars, but also if correlation table get very huge, you might also consider to use some superscripts, like for example small a to refer b is smaller than 0.001 or something like that. And if you carry out regression analysis, path analysis, structural equation modeling, or anything that is based on association, correlational linear associations, then correlation matrix is typically something that you always report, and correlation matrix already tells quite a lot what you can expect regarding your results. And of course it's also important to check how your, if you have several predictor variables, how they are correlated, that you don't have any multicollinearity problems. Well, then if we come back to the statistical inference thing, some words about that. And then after that we will go back to choosing the right method. So here is another figure just to summarize this idea, that you have this target population, and then you have to think about how generalizable to the target population are the estimates and statistics you have calculated from your sample. And from your sample, you typically are interested in statistical significance of the estimates or statistics calculated from the samples, and then you calculate standard errors and confidence intervals from the samples, and based on these, you may be able to do some generalizations about population. And of course, from theory, this is very important. You typically formulate some hypothesis that you will test with your sample. And then some words about confidence intervals. So these different statistics, for example mean, in case you haven't studied all the possible children that live in Finland, is you cannot kind of calculate it from the actual target population precisely, but then and it cannot precisely be, of course, calculated based on the sample, which is just sample of that big population. But however, based on the sample, you can evaluate probability in which this mean value is within certain range. And in order to be able to calculate confidence interval for the target statistic, for example, mean, then you need information about standard errors, error which is average deviation in the statistic proportional to sample size. And confidence intervals, they describe the amount of uncertainty. If you have really huge confidence intervals within which strength your mean might be, then it's kind of more uncertain those your conclusions based on the data. If confidence intervals are very small, then you are kind of more certain about your conclusions. And here are some examples of calculating confidence intervals for supporting NATO membership when 45% have voted for NATO and 55% against NATO, and sample size is 1,000, and here is equation for calculating standard error in this kind of case. And then for supporting, calculating this 95 confidence interval for supporting data, you can calculate like this p plus minus 1.96 times standard error. And this 1.96 is coming from that you particularly want to calculate this 95 confidence intervals. You could also calculate smaller like 99 or 99.9 or something like that. And then confidence interval of the mean, here is the equation for standard error, is kind of standard deviation that you can calculate from your data, from your sample, and divided by square root of your sample size. And here is the equation for calculation confidence intervals. Quite many softwares also calculate these, but sometimes they don't in some cases, so it might be good to know how to calculate. And as you probably know, it's also a side of the fact that confidence intervals tells you something about uncertainty or certainty of your statistical conclusions. It's also possible to make conclusions about statistical significance based on the confidence intervals. And a rule of the thumb in most cases is that if confidence intervals do not contain zero, then parameter can be concluded to be statistically significant. But there are some exceptions, for example, in logistic regression, then if confidence intervals do not contain one, the parameter can be concluded to be statistically significant. In this case, of course, calculation is a little bit different, but then if it would be one, then it would be just like throwing the coin, so then you need something bigger or smaller. And I don't know how many of you have faced this fact, but at least in the field of psychology, there is some tendency that some journals also nowadays require reporting confidence intervals aside of reporting point estimates of the parameters. It's kind of more acknowledged that it's a bit problematic just to share this one point estimate of p-value. And some journals even recommend using only confidence intervals for making conclusions about statistical significance. Like forget p-values completely and only report on confidence intervals. So this is something that it's probably somehow good to keep in mind that there are also other ways to think about statistical significance just aside of that classical p-value. And also, well, previous examples were about calculating symmetric confidence intervals, but of course confidence intervals are not always symmetric. For example, when if you are interested in indirect mediator effects, then if you use bootstrap and you calculate bias-corrected confidence intervals, they are typically non-symmetric, so that's also a possibility. This is just a side note, but okay. I think we can then go forward to hypothesis testing. And this part is based on more this classical test theory, but I think that all the time it's good to keep in mind also confidence intervals. And after going this part through, I will also talk just briefly about statistical power and also effect sizes here and there, because I think all these things are very, very important, not just this classical p-value. But most quantitative methods, they are based on statistical hypotheses, and their statistics are formed on the basis of zero hypotheses and probability distribution of these test statistics. And in hypothesis testing, it contains five different phases. First, you need to choose your hypothesis. Usually you have some theory for this. You have some research questions you want to test. And then you need to choose statistical test, what is appropriate for your research question. Then you also need to choose the significance level. Quite often it might be 0.05, but it might be also smaller. Then you need to perform the test and then do some statistical inference and conclusions about the results. And I guess that researcher is needed. All these phases, of course, machine is calculating typically the concrete statistics, but you need to kind of know what you want to test and what statistical method is suitable in that situation. And then you have to be able to interpret the results, because machine is of course just machine, but you are the researcher who is controlling what you are doing. And here I have just one side note that I'm not going deeper to this in this course. This would earn, I think, in own course. But other possibility than using this classical test theory is also to use Bayesian approach. I don't know how familiar you are in it, but statistical reasoning is a bit different in Bayesian approach, and typically you have some a priori distributions and assumptions, and then you kind of update your probabilities of your hypothesis when you get more information of the data, and then you calculate some posterior probabilities and so on. But I don't go deeper to that, but it's good to keep in mind that there are also other possibilities. Then about choosing the hypothesis. When you aim to test statistical significance of certain parameter, it can be mean, correlation, regression coefficient, almost anything, variance, it can be always formulated in the form of zero hypothesis and its alternative hypothesis. And setting these hypotheses also involve some generalizations towards a population based on the sample. Of course, you have to take your reservations account regarding representativeness and so on, but basically. And the idea is that zero hypothesis defines the phenomenon, and in turn, alternative hypothesis cancels this definition. in other words, even though your content-wise interest is actually in alternative hypotheses, you cannot test it directly, but you will get support for your alternative hypotheses via getting via rejecting your zero hypotheses. For example, if you expect that girls are have better skills in reading, for example, if that's what you are interested in, then you cannot directly test it, but typically your test is so that, for example, the zero hypothesis that no differences are observed between girls and boys, and then you will see that whether you get kind of support to reject that zero hypothesis, and then you will get support to that actual thing that you are interested in. And then the statistical reasoning leads you rejecting zero hypotheses in certain probabilities estimated from the data. In most cases, it's p. If p is smaller than 0.5, then you can reject your zero hypothesis. Then there is only small probability that zero hypothesis is true, basically. And here is an example of gender differences in depressive symptoms. So there is an example how you can formulate your hypothesis. Like your zero hypothesis is women and men do not differ in depressive symptoms, and this hypothesis is against the assumption that you have derived, probably from your theory. And then alternative hypothesis, if it would be two-tailed testing, it would be like women and men, they do differ in depressive symptoms, but you don't take any stance whether women or men are higher. Or then one-tailed testing would be that you expect only one direction, like that women would report on average more depressive symptoms than men. So the aim here is to get support in order to be able to reject zero hypothesis, and then you will get support for this alternative hypothesis. And then if we think about choosing the statistical test, it of course depends on the content of your hypothesis, your theory, research questions, but also properties of the data. Sometimes it can be that you have nice hypotheses and you think that you will do, for example, you will carry out variance analysis, for example, but if it turns out that your empirical distributions are something very different than you expected, then it might be that you have to consider whether you have to do either some variable transformation or use non-parametric test, or even kind of use some cutoffs and make your outcome variable categorical or something if normality assumptions are hugely violated. And many quantitative methods, they include automatically certain statistical tests and certain type of pair of hypotheses. But then you as a researcher, you need to select from this huge amount of different possible softwares and appropriate statistical tests what would be the best one for answering research questions. Of course, statistical software is just a tool. You can choose, quite many softwares can do the same thing. So it's of course what you are also used to and what you think that is easy to use. Sometimes there are also in some things there of course are so that there are strengths in some statistical softwares and then weaknesses, and then sometimes you have to know something about those too. But I guess biggest thing is anyway to select the appropriate statistical tests and then software what is available and what you are kind of comfortable to use. And then choose applicable definitions of data analysis and then interpretate the results. And then also usually you need to choose some significance level beforehand. And choosing this significance level, it defines probability for the fact that you reject zero hypothesis, even though it's true. That is also same than probability of rejection errors, error risk level, or probability of type 1 error. I have some slides further. I tell a little bit more about this, these statistical errors. And typical significance levels are 0.05, 0.01, or 0.001. And significance levels is typically defined theoretically. And it might all be also that your data impacts. If you have really huge data, it might be that you want to make this your significance level relatively strict, so that you don't get all the possible tiny results, even though they don't have any practical importance, that you don't get all those results significant. And also, if you carry out, for example, variance analysis and you have a big number of groups that you compare, if you carry out very many pairwise comparisons, kind of just more or less exploratively, then in some point you will get statistically significant result just by chance. So then it might be good that you do some Ponferroni correction or something to your significance level, that you are not too liberal. But anyway, then p-value is something that you calculate empirically from the data, and then you get support or not support for zero hypothesis. And but for example, if you get p-value which is smaller than 0.05, then probability for rejection error is below 5%. There is still some probability that you reject zero hypothesis, even though it's true, but it's anyway very unlikely. And of course, this one-tailored versus two-tailored hypothesis also can impact your significance level if you use if you have good theoretical reasons to test one-tailored testing, then and you have one-tailored hypothesis, then of course you can also adjust p-value for that too. And then something about performing statistical tests. In most cases, you do it with some statistical program, for example, SPSS, Data, SAS, M+. And as a result, you will get p-value, which defines the probability of reject zero hypothesis, even though it's true. First, you derive from your theory zero hypothesis and alternative hypothesis. Then you attempt to reject this zero hypothesis when you have your data, and then you calculate p-value with the appropriate test, and then after that you can do some conclusions. And then still some words about statistical inference and diagnostics. So when the value of the test statistic is in the end of the distribution, it can be said that it's in the critical region of the probability distribution. And that means that values that correspond to zero hypothesis are possible anywhere with very small likelihood. But it's good to be in mind that also sample size impacts the distribution of the test statistic. But soon I will tell a little bit about the role of sample size and effect sizes too. And some warnings here also, what I have already briefly mentioned, that it's good to keep in mind that p-value is only a point estimate. and choice of specific significance level is more or less arbitrary. There is always chance that you may do wrong conclusions, and it's very important, I think, to report also effect sizes, because then sample size impacts so much to p-value that from effect sizes you can more easily compare the results across different studies, and you can think about practical importance of the results, and also you might consider reporting those confidence intervals. Well, here is one slide about statistical errors. We are not going very deep to this, but just remind about this. And we talk about kind of type 1 error and type 2 error. And here is like in reality whether zero hypothesis is true or false, and then if zero hypothesis, when you get p value, calculate p value from your data, whether you then kind of zero hypothesis is accepted or whether it is rejected. If in real world zero hypothesis is true, then of course it's okay to accept it. Or if zero hypothesis is false, it's okay to reject it. That's what you would like, but then there are always some possibilities for this error, and this type 1 error is called if in reality zero hypothesis is true, but then it's rejected. It's kind of you in real world there are no differences, for example, in depressive symptoms of women and men, but then you still reject your zero hypothesis and make conclusions that, well, there is some gender difference. And then in the other second type of error is that if you in real time your zero hypothesis is false, in real time, in real world, there is gender difference between women and men, but then zero hypothesis is still accepted. That is, even with your data, you are unable to reject the zero hypothesis. It might be that you don't have enough power, you have too small sample size or something like that. Effect is maybe small, but you kind of are not able to get statistical significant result, even though it is there. And this alpha type for the probability for type 1 error and beta probability for type 2 error, they are marked with these alpha and beta symbols. And these statistical error types also depend on each other. For example, if you set very low limit to rejection error, then of course your risk for acceptance error increases and vice versa. And it depends on your research question, which statistical error is more serious. Is it more serious to get significant results even though there is actually no effect in real world, or is it other way around? And here is a little bit more about probabilities and how these probabilities are tied to each other. And we can also look these other sides of these alpha and beta probabilities. 1 minus alpha is probability that true zero hypothesis is accepted, which was okay. Then we had these rejection cases, error cases. But then 1 minus beta is probability that false zero hypothesis is rejected, which is okay. This is, in a way, your main aim. And this also probability refers also to power of your test when certain significance level is chosen. that is how likely it is to obtain statistically significant result from your analysis, that is reject zero hypothesis if zero hypothesis in real world is it false. And I think this power is something that is really important to think if you plan collecting data. It's something that it's good to think about a little bit already beforehand, how big sample you should collect, how big you expect that the effects are, and so that you would collect that data that if there is the phenomenon, then you would be able to show it statistically. If power is low, then you have really hard time to get evidence for your main research questions. And overall, as a rule of thumb, you could say that in order to minimize probability of these statistical errors, then the power of statistical testing needs to be sufficiently high. There is some rule of thumb that it would be optimal if power would be at least 80%. And power of statistical testing is influenced by both sample size and magnitude of the effects. For example, if the difference between two means is very large, there is huge difference between women and men's depressive symptoms, for example, then it's possible that, well, you don't need so big sample size. Effect is so clear that you can show it even with relatively small sample size. But in situation is different, really different with gender difference is only small, then you need much bigger sample size in order to show this small, even though real gender difference statistically significant. And then, of course, the other side of the coins also, if sample size is small, very small, it's possible that you are not able to show the statistically significant result difference between women and men in depressive symptoms, even though there is actual difference. And then it's, of course, not nice situation for you as a researcher if that was your main goal of your project, and then you are not able to show it. And then still another point, that if sample size, as I already briefly mentioned, if sample size is very big, almost anything is statistically significant, so it's very important to pay attention to effect sizes too. And well, I don't go to details to these power things. This is also probably something that would maybe earn own course, but as said, it's worthwhile to consider carrying out power analysis before starting research project, starting collecting data. Think before how big sample size you want to collect in order to get confirmation for your interesting research ideas. Of course, it's possible to carry out some power calculation also after statistical testing. It's called empirical estimation of the power. And regarding calculating power, there are different equation procedures, different methods, and, well, quite complex but important topic. Typically, you need some a priori information, maybe based on previous studies, published studies, or from your other data, how big you expect that the effect would be, how large would be association, for example, how closely parenting styles would be related to size adjustment. You usually need some guess about the effect size beforehand. And then also there are some power calculators that you can use if you vary you vary side of the effect and sample size, and then you can kind of get any power different power calculations. And also there is always possibility to carry out some simulation studies to calculate power, but I guess that I will not stop here so long time because this is just brief introductory lecture. But some small words still about effect sizes and statistical power. Effect size it can be said that it's an estimate of the magnitude of the effect, and then power, as said, is the probability of the statistical test to detect the effect if it exists. And well, this is the same what I already have emphasized, that at a side of p-value, it's important to take into account also sample size, effect size, and power. And here are some examples of effect size estimates. There are also some others, and probably also some other rules of thumbs too. Depends on situation, but Cohen is some classic who has suggested some rules of thumbs for what would be small and medium or large effect size. Quite often, if you want to compare two means, then Cohen's D is one effect size estimate that you often report, kind of difference between means relative to standard deviation. And then, of course, a correlation coefficient in itself can be thought that it tells something about power. Similarly, standardized beta coefficients. And here is also this Q statistics for if you compare to independent correlations. And then in regression analysis, usually this R square proportion of explained variance, 1% rho would be small, 6% medium. If it's more bigger than 0.14, it's already relatively large, but of course it depends on research field also. I think that some fields that it's more typical than in these human sciences to get big effect sizes, some might say that all of these are very small, that you need to be able to explain at least 60% of the variance. But in, for example, in our psychological data, it's quite challenging. And of course, one thing is also about reliability of the measurement, how much there is measurement error. And then in variance analysis, eta square or partial eta square can be interpreted a bit like this R square too. But here are some examples that you may use when what effect size estimates to consider to report, and then of course if you report them, it might be worthwhile in your discussion of your paper also so briefly comment whether magnitude of the effects was small or medium or large. And about statistical inference then, as I have now talked about it from different perspectives, I guess that it's evident that there are some problems in statistical inference. It's not perfect. For example, are samples really random samples from those populations? Challenges of missing data? Influence of sample size on the results? Zero hypothesis is in most cases quite trivial. And p-value is just based on general agreement. What about if you get p-value 0.051, for example? if you get this kind of p-value, do you say strongly like there is no effect, definitely girls and boys do not differ, but if you get p-value like 0.049, do you say strongly, well, this is now very something important, it's kind of, this is just telling about that, it's just something that we have agreed that, well, it's probably is small, but yeah, I guess it's important to consider these other aspects to the effect sizes and so. And of course, there are also some practical challenges. Were statistical tests conducted properly and were these content-wise interpretations kept carefully in mind? But I guess that I would still conclude that, of course, there are some problems in statistical inference and testing. That's true. But and it's good to be aware of these limitations. But probably statistical tests still gives us some useful tools. Probably it's better that we have these tools than no tools. Kind of better to use statistical tests than entirely give up on evaluation of significance levels. But this is, of course, something that every researcher can be thinking about. So I think now I would spend the rest of this lecture about this choosing the right method and reporting the results. I guess that the main title in this course is this reporting, but I think these things that I have been talking about before this section, I think this is something that is very important, all these things that we talk now and what Asko will be talking about and what is good to be keeping in mind when you think how you want to present your data, how you want to write your story and what you want to present and what is important and what you think about the results. So next we could talk a little bit from moving from research questions and measurement to actual data analysis. So you typically have some research problem and then you do some operationalization. You collect a sample and then you construct some measures that hopefully are valid, and then using these measures, you measure some variables. It might be questionnaire data, for example. And based on these variables, you probably have some scales. For example, depressive symptoms. It might be that you don't ask it by only one question, but maybe 10 questions. And all those 10 questions form a nice scale. And then, of course, you need to think about distributions of the variables, reliability, maybe construct some sum scores or latent factors, and carry out this descriptive analysis. And after this, you can move to investigating associations between variables and multivariate data analysis. And here you need to choose the right method, keeping in mind your research questions, scale of the variables, and other assumptions of the statistical methods, and then conclusions based on the analysis, and then you need to report and generalize. And then if we think about choosing the appropriate statistical methods, there are of course many things that impacts that. First of all, research design. Do you have cross-sectional research design so that you have only one time point, you have measured your participant only once, or is your design longitudinal, you have repeated measurements of the same participants? If you have longitudinal data, it requires that you somehow model or take into account dependency of observations across time, and somehow probably you are interested in studying change modeling change, what factors predict changes occurring across time. And then, of course, when we think about concrete choice of the statistical method, then also number and nature of independent and dependent variables play a role. And they scales too. And also you can think whether the aim is to control individual differences in regards to certain covariates, whether you have some that kind of variables that you want to include in the model too. And research questions are key. I think everything should start from research questions. Then after that you will think about what kind of variables you have, and in order to answer that research question, then it kind of leads to some research statistical tool. Is your aim to study separate variables, associations between two or more variables, or perhaps group the cases? And then also properties of the data and variables, sample size, measurable scales, categorical or continuous, and then statistical assumptions. And here is some summary of different statistical tools. I don't claim that all the possible methods are included here, but it kind of gives some overview. First of all, these descriptive statistical tools, what we already talked about. But then for investigating associations between variables, cross-tabulation, log-linear models, correlation coefficient, factor analysis, if you want to group variables, variance analysis, ANOVA-MANOVA, repeated ANOVA-MANOVA, linear regression analysis, or then nonlinear regression analysis, or Poisson regression analysis, it can be something else too. And general linear models, it's something that combines quite flexibly aspects of variance analysis and linear regression analysis, that you can have different kind of predictor variables, categorical and continuous, in your model simultaneously. And then logistic regression analysis, if you have only two categories in your outcome variables, it's binary logistic regression analysis, or then if you have three or more categories that you want to predict in your outcome variable, then it's multinomial logistic regression analysis. Or then path models, structural equation models. You can, Asko will talk more about these, but you can kind of think that these are kind of generalizations that combine aspects of confirmatory factor analysis and then also regression analysis, but then you can flexibly model and investigate interesting complex patterns of between variables in your models using these methods. With classical linear regression, for example, with SPSS, you only can have one dependent variable at a time, but if you have several, then it might be that it's more flexible to construct path models rather than run 50 different regression analyses. And then, of course, probably I don't go deeper to this causality thing, but I guess that quite often researcher might be interested in also some mediator or moderator effects, if there are some intermediate mechanisms between your X and Y variable, or whether associations between X and Y are depending on some other characteristics, for example, whether size, temperament moderate how different parenting practices impact child outcomes, or if parenting has different role on different things, what parents do have different effect on children depending child characteristics. Or then third is whether your aim is to group the cases instead of investigating linear associations or some of these usually, well, all, not all these methods assume linearity necessarily, but quite often do. But then one thing that might be very interesting is to investigate some subpopulations or subgroups in your data. For example, some depression trajectories. Is it so that everybody follow the similar kind of trajectory, but might could there be some increasing or decreasing stable trajectories and model individual differences in those changes? Or then group the cases based on different, several different variables and find different patterns of students, for example, of values in students. And these grouping methods are typically cluster analysis or mixture modeling. I will briefly mention something about this, but I think that Asko will talk you more about. And here is then one table about choosing the statistical method. This is, of course, I think these are probably good rules of thumbs, but then if we think these classical statistical methods, but then if we think about general linear models and all these structural equation models, they can actually be so flexible that they can, if you just know how to organize your data, they can handle all these boxes. That though it's not necessarily always like this, but just some kind of classical rules of thumbs maybe. And here is your explanatory variable, independent variable, and here is your outcome variable, dependent variable, y variable, and then here is the scale, whether your x variable scale is nominal or ordinal, or whether it's interval or relational scale, and same for your y variable, then to which statistical tool that might lead. If your both x and y are the categorical, then typically it might lead to some cross-tabulation, log linear model, or some different categorical analysis where you handle probabilities. In turn, if your x variable is categorical, but your y variable, dependent variables, is continuous, then you typically are in this variance analysis family, t-test, ANOVA, MANOVA. In turn, if your x variable is continuous, but then your y variable is categorical, then it's typically this logistic regression analysis, and then it depends how many categories in your y variable includes then. Yes?
Can you just say the definition of non-ordinary intervalent relation?
Yes.
Yes,
yes. So no, well, in generally, categorical is something that there are some certain categories that its variable is not continuous, but this nominal is something qualitatively different, like girls and boys that you cannot order. You cannot order like that the value is smaller, whereas the ordinal scale is that you have certain categories like unemployed, some short courses, and fully employed, or something that you can think still that you, and if you want to analyze the data so that there is some interesting information all those categories, whether it's nominal or ordinal, then I think then you are in here. But then interval or relational scale is that it's more or less your variable is of course there is some fine graded differences between these two, but the idea that your variable is continuous, that you have some typically normal distribution like that for example. Well, actually, one thing is also that, at least in psychology, we have actually many liquor-type questions. And, for example, well, that life satisfaction or depressive symptoms, if you go detail to look those categories, of course, those single items are ordinal also, like disagree and something between those. But then I think in practice, if you measure with several different items, for example, with that life satisfaction, and if you construct sum scores based on several different items that measure a little bit different aspect of the phenomenon, sum scores or latent factor, then this sum score or latent factor of life satisfaction, it starts resembling continuous variable and behaving a bit like continuous variable, that you will get distribution and so. So we often treat these kind of sum score variables as continuous. And of course, it's also, if you have very many small categories like decimal points, like 2.1 and 2.3 and 2.4, there is probably not enough information to compare all pairwise categories like 2.1 decimals versus 2.2, but rather it's modeled like continuous. But this is something that it's good to think about and be aware of, whether you think your scales, whether it's ordinal, and whether you analyze it by using somehow ordinal methods, or whether you think it's more or less behaves like continuous, or whether you have true continuous. Yes?
So Likert scale, a simple question. Likert scale is an interval scale, right?
Yeah.
And what is an example of the relational scale?
Well, it's something like, for example, your height, pituus. For example, it can be something very...
Right? That's an ordinal scale.
No, but it's continuous. Kind of every people, there is just, you cannot, such small differences between our heights. And if there are some other examples, you can also say about continuous variable. But yeah. Yeah. Okay. Anyway, well, probably that differentiation, categorical and continuous, is perhaps important here to think about in which box you are moving. So, if you have continuous x variable and then your y variable is categorical, then typically you are in this logistic regression analysis family. Whereas if your x and y variables are both continuous, then you might consider methods like linear regression analysis and pattern structural equation models and so on. But it's good to remind that it's also possible to, for example, if you have two category variables, it's possible to include so-called dummy variables in regression analysis and these path models. If you have ordinal categories, like some, for example, different educational background categories, it's possible, instead of treating them as kind of nominal or ordinal, it's possible to dummy code all of them. It's possible to combine these also, but then if it's something really nominal, it's necessary that you dummy code. Otherwise, it's impossible to use methods where you investigate associations of the variables. If there is no order, like pears and apples and something, then you can not say that higher or lower something, then it increases y variable. And then about parametric versus non-parametric tests, I see that time is flying, but I think I can try to speed up for this rest of the lecture, and I guess that I will leave this just as a short notice, but of course, if your statistical assumptions are not met, there is always possibility also to use non-parametric tests. Non-parametric tests say include no assumptions regarding distribution. Of course, bad side is that there is lower statistical power, but if you are worried about your distributions, then it's safe anyway. At least you don't have to worry about. Whereas parametric tests, they include assumptions regarding distributions, and often there are also some other assumptions regarding shape of associations between the variables, whether it's linear or equality of variables between compared group or something like that. And well, I guess as a general rule of thumb, it might be good to think that if statistical assumptions are met, it's recommendable to choose parametric tests as they are more powerful in statistically testing. And of course, it's also possible to consider some variable transformation to meet statistical assumptions. And in some statistical programs, just M+, there are also some estimators that can kind of correct possible biases due to some non-normalities. And I think that this slide I will just briefly show you have received all this material, but this is just analogies like that you can, it's possible to find for parametric correlation, it's possible to find non-parametric correlation, and for all these different type of variance analysis, it's possible to find also non-parametric test that is testing the same thing. And then I think I mentioned already about this person-oriented versus variable-oriented approach, and classical person-oriented approach is this classification of individuals into subgroups based on pattern similarity. Classical cluster analysis methods, there is typically basis of some distance criteria between cases. But then this mixture modeling that Asko will probably talk you more about, it's somehow between these classical variable-oriented and person-oriented methods. That idea is to, theoretical idea is also, as in a cluster analysis, is to identify subgroups of individuals, but these subgroups are identified based on certain model parameters, so you also assume some statistical model here. And I think to finish, I think probably 5 minutes or something, I think I would like to show you some examples of reporting statistical results, cross-tabulation, t-test, variance analysis, regression analysis. I will show you some tables, some figures, some examples how to report this in text. But of course, this one lecture in general is very short to go to very short details, but I hope that you will get some overview, and then in afternoon when you have this group working session, then you will have chance to think about this in more detail, and after Asko's lecture also kind of discuss in more detail and go stop thinking about these things in more detail depending on your research questions and so. But well, here are some examples of reporting cross-tabulation in table and text. Here is this example is in Finnish, but anyway, there are different categorical variables such as gender, teacher's gender, working experience, and working experience with their own classroom, and then there are different kind of roles in bullying situations and how well these teachers recognize these bullying roles. Teacher either what proportion and how many teachers recognize or doesn't recognize the role, kind of rated by peers. And in this table, both percentages and sample sizes for these different cells are reported, but then also high square test, decrease of freedom, test statistics, p-value and Kramer's p also as effect size estimate is reported, and also those adjusted standardized residuals are reported in the table where there is some under or over representation of in some cells. And here is an example of reporting cross-tabulation in text, like cross-tabulation, then side of the table of parent text and parenting style subtype, then high square, decrease of freedom, maybe sample size, high square test statistics, p-value and effect size indicated that mothers and fathers differed in their parenting styles in comparison to fathers, and then you report your adjusted residuals. Mothers were more likely to be in authoritative parenting style subtype. Fathers, in turn, were more likely to be in the other type. These are kind of examples how you might report these results in your paper.
Excuse me.
Yes?
In case you find the difference significant and you count the Kramer's p-value, are there some suggestions about how to interpret the number of Kramer's pi?
I think if I hopefully remember right, I think if I remember right, now I should check it, but I would remember it if it's something like 0.10, 0.15, it would be quite small effect size, and if it's 0.40, 50, 60, then it's maybe moderate and so on. But I think I don't have here any specific kind of ranges, but it's good to think about that too. And of course in this cross-tabulations, it's also good to look your percentages in itself, in somehow they also in a way tell also something about how under or over represented, for example, women or men are in some category compared to the situation that they would be completely equally distributed. And here is an example of reporting t-test in text. Well, in this case, this is part of the attrition analysis. It might be that you report your means and standard deviations also in table. In that case, you might say that means and standard deviations of these and these variables are found in table 1, and then results showed, and then you would report only these statistics in the text. But in this case, there are also means and standard deviations. Anyway, means are here important, and standard deviation to report. But regarding t-test, you typically report t and then decrease of freedom, test statistic, p-value, and, well, for example, Cohen's d. And here is an example of reporting variance analysis in table. Typically, when you report variance analysis, you also report means and standard deviation. In this case, there were 6 different groups, and then 3 different outcome variables. Then you report your F. And then the after statistic, decrease of freedom for the effect and error. And then, well, in this case, it has been reported partial eta square. And then in table, different superscript have been used to indicate which means differ statistically significantly from each other. This is one possible way to report the results in table. And I think in analysis strategy, the pairwise comparison method is reported, or it should be reported also somewhere. Of course, you could report this also in the text. Here is an example of reporting ANOVA in the text. I think that time is probably too short to go very detailed way through these examples via text, but I think that you will get the some examples, like for what the statistics typically are reported in different methods when you report, and some examples how you might write them in a text or in tables. And I have added here also references, so if you are interested, you might also find the actual papers and read the actual whole story, how it has been written, and then think how it might apply to your own research. And then here is also an example of reporting regression analysis in table, and this article was something that you will also discuss about in afternoon session. You might want to have a look, like how descriptive statistics are reported, how the sample is described, and then how these regression analyses are reported in the text. But of course, in this course, we can just provide some examples. There are also other examples and other ways to write the story and so, but some maybe somehow generally agreed things. And here are hierarchical regression analyses, and here is the outcome variable, and then here are the predictor variables, and it's reported R zero order correlation between X and Y, and then beta coefficient. This is of course different from zero order correlations, because these predictor variables are controlled for each other, and they kind of compete it with each other who will have the biggest effects, and if there are some correlations between predictor variables, then they will also impact. And then R square also is important to report. But I think I will stop here. I think Asko will next talk about describing analysis strategy and reporting statistical results of structural equation modeling, multi-level modeling, and mixture modeling. I think Asko will start quarter past as according to program. So now we have some break, and of course, if you have some questions, I'm happy to stay here and answer.